Today marks 100 years to the day since Parliament in Northern Ireland was officially opened by King George V. Only 6 months earlier, the Government of Ireland Act had introduced partition in Ireland by legislating for two new Home Rule parliaments, one in Belfast and one in Dublin. We'll go to Belfast now and join our Decade of Commemorations series editor, Shane McElhattan.
Thanks, Mary. You join us here in the magnificent sun-drenched surroundings of City Hall, Belfast, which was the setting 100 years ago today for one of the most important speeches ever made in the history of this island. King George V formally opened the Belfast Parliament, but the King's inauguration speech not only gave prestige to the new entity of Northern Ireland, it sent out coded peace feelers to Sinn Féin and the IRA as the War of Independence was locked in stalemate. Within weeks, the war was over. We're here to talk about these seismic events, and we'll be continuing this discussion after 9 o'clock on the digital news channel, if you can stay with us. I'm joined now by Dr. Marie Coleman, lecturer in Irish history, Queen's University Belfast. She's a member of the Northern Ireland Centenary Historical Advisory Panel. Dr. Eamon Phoenix, political historian at Strathmillan University College and a member of the Taoiseach's Expert Advisory Group on Commemorations. And Professor Brian Walker, Professor Emeritus of Irish Studies at Queen's University Belfast. Now, I've sketched the broad context in which the speech must be seen, but could I start by asking all three of you for the elevator pitch? Like, why should people be interested? Why should people take invest this speech with importance? Mary?
I suppose, first of all, it was gave the Royal Seal of Approval to partition and the creation of Northern Ireland. Partition came in theoretically with the passing of the legislation in December, then the practical application was made, but really the ceremony which made people realise that partition was a reality and Northern Ireland was here to stay, in the meantime at least, came with that great ceremony on that day.
Eamon?
Yes, pomp and ceremony, but of course this was the transformative moment really in the history of the whole island rather than just the north. He set the seal in partition to the chagrin of nationalists and republicans, but of course the king was interested in unlocking the violence, finding a peace process. He was interested in Ireland, as his grandson Prince Charles reminded historians here a few weeks ago, and he wanted to say something of moment, and he did.
Brian.
Well, it's a great symbolic value for unionists. This is the establishment of the Northern Ireland Parliament. It had already been constituted a couple of weeks before, but this was a formal opening, very important. But it was also this reaching out, this appeal to all Irish people. He hoped this would be an important moment, not just for the six counties, as he says, but for the rest of Ireland and for the rest of the world looking on. He hoped this would be an important point of change.
Could I put it to the panel that this was at two directions at once, masterstroke? One hand, he gives prestige and comfort to the new entity of Northern Ireland. On the other, he's sending a coded message to Sinn Féin that allows Lloyd George political cover to make contact with Eamon de Valera. And it's no coincidence that the war is over within 3 weeks.
I think that's true, and I think the importance there is the person of the King. Even the Prime Minister, Lloyd George, writing to the King a few days afterwards, said none but the King could have made that personal appeal, none but the King could have evoked so instantaneous a response. Coming from a politician, coming from Lloyd George, who the Irish nationalists, the Irish Republicans, did not trust with good reason, it wouldn't have carried the same weight. So the King being above politics, being the head of state, he alone in his own person carried an awful lot of significance.
Yes, and the speech seems there's this personal element to it. I mean, as head of state, he would be, in one hand, stating government policies, but on the other hand, he had this personal attachment to Ireland, as he goes out of his way to explain. So it's very important in that way that it expresses not just the government's point of view, his own point of view, and it does make a big impression.
Well, Craig, of course, was delighted that his homeland that he had envisioned for the previous 20 years outside a nationalist parliament in Dublin had the seal set on it by the King. But the King was interested in Ireland. He had intervened at the Buckingham Palace conference in 1914 to avert civil war then. He had a very, very great concern about the reprisals policy of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, which was obviously underwritten by his government. And he was speaking to General Jan Smuts, of course, who had contacts with de Valera through Tom Casement, Casement's brother. So, I mean, his speech was heavily overwritten by all of these hands, especially General Smuts.
In terms of Premier.
I beg your pardon?
The South African Premier.
The South African Prime Minister, who had been a rebel in arms against the British Crown during the Second Boer War 20 years earlier, and was now a loyal Dominions Prime Minister, trying to persuade Sinn Féin to accept a gradualist approach to an all-Ireland republic, accept Dominion status. So the King knew where he was going. There had been previous peace overtures that year. Through Lloyd George, they had failed. James Craig had met De Valera at Lloyd George's more or less command on the 5th of May. And each sort of knew the other's bottom line. So the King was making a speech to change the situation, and it was transformative.
I think we'll play a clip now of the reenactment of the speech done by the actor Stephen Beggs for this occasion. And we're going to hear more of it in after 9 o'clock. We're going to sort of parse some of the segments. But the segment that gets so much attention is the one where he again holds out the vision of a separate future for Ireland, for the rest of Ireland, inside the empire, but also a strong hint that it was time to talk.
The eyes of the whole empire are on Ireland today. That empire in which so many nations and races have come together in spite of ancient feuds, and in which new nations have come to birth within the lifetime of the youngest in this hall. I am emboldened by that thought to look beyond the sorrow and the anxiety which have clouded of late my vision of Irish affairs. I speak from a full heart when I pray that my coming to Ireland today may prove to be the first step towards an end of strife amongst her people, whatever their race or creed. In that hope, I appeal to all Irishmen to pause, to stretch out the hand of forbearance and conciliation, to forgive and to forget, and to join in making for the land which they love a new era of peace, contentment, and goodwill.
Who picked up on the signals from the speech first? Was it Sinn Féin, or was it Lloyd George, who now had the cover, the political cover, to make an approach to Eamon de Valera and say it's time to talk? Or was there some awareness in the Sinn Féin ranks to how important this speech was?
I think there's a level of orchestration. I notice in that segment we heard the King says it's the first step towards an end of strife, but it's not really. As Eamon said previously, this is part of a wider process with peace moves which went back to late 1920. So I think they knew to look for a signal. This speech takes place not in a vacuum, but in a much wider context of moves between senior civil servants in Dublin Castle, like Andy Cope, making approaches to Sinn Féin. When De Valera came back to Ireland at the end of 1920, he was allowed back into the country. There was a sense that he needed to be there. So there's a much wider network of contacts between the British and the Irish, and this is almost set up to send a signal. It sends that signal, and by the 24th of June, 2 days later, Lloyd George is writing to De Valera to ask him to come and talk to him.
Brian, could I ask you about the background to the opening of Parliament? Because in September of 1920, nothing existed. That there was no infrastructure, there was no administration, and Sir Ernest Clarke sent up from Dublin to take up the post of Assistant Under-Secretary for Belfast, armed, as he said, with a table, a chair, and an Act of Parliament. What sort of achievement was it to get to where they got to by June?
Well, it was a major achievement. Now, Sir Ernest Clarke comes to Belfast before the Government of Ireland Act comes into play. I mean, it's been debated in Parliament, but it's pretty clear it's going to go through in some form. So he comes here in September, meets people, meets Craig, meets others. He then sets up a base here and sets about establishing departments, establishing a civil service. So when the new Parliament meets for the first time, and as it does 2 weeks before this date that we're talking about today, already he has drawn up plans for departments, drawn up plans for a civil service, and these are well established by this stage. So it's an important development because coming to being just on this day, if you hadn't laid these plans, it would have been very difficult. Now, in the event, it still takes a number of months before everything is transferred from Dublin. In fact, it's not until early 1922 that all powers are transferred from Dublin. But these stages are well underway by the date we're talking about today, and that was very important.
Now, if we looked out these windows here behind us, 100 years ago, we would have seen pomp and ceremony, but a few streets away, the violence in Belfast, which had been gathering pace since the summer of 1920, was reaching something of a crescendo. The Irish Independent was reporting that 150 Catholic families were thrown out of their homes in the previous week alone.
Yes. In the pre-12th days, of course, before the King's visit, 150 Catholic families, mainly ex-soldiers, were burnt out of their houses at the lower end of the Shankill Road streets. And, of course, there had been a reprisal killing to an IRA attack in Belfast in which three nationalists were killed just a few days earlier. And 30 people would die between the King's visit, despite his conciliatory words, and the end of July in Belfast alone, in this ongoing sectarian and political strife which lasted until September 1922 and was only curbed then by curfew and other measures. So you have that whole background to the whole affair. I mean, the King's speech was directed at De Valera in the south. His antennae were very sensitive to this. He was in touch with people like Tom Casement, Smuts. He knew something was coming. The nationalist press reaction in Dublin was certainly very positive. Even the Unionist Irish Times welcomed the King's remarks. And that all enabled Lloyd George to act, as he put it, in his invitation to De Valera, in the spirit of the King's words. And that squashed the kind of war party in the Tory party who wanted to 200,000 troops sent in, as Henry Wilson did, to crush the IRA once and for all. Boer war tactics, which would outrage American opinion, for one thing, and liberal
and
opinion
opinions,
in Britain.
Yeah.
So the King was coming at a nodal moment. And, I mean, he played a blinder as regards bringing about an end to violence in the south. But the northern violence continued unremittingly.
But it's a point worth making. The violence doesn't stop. The violence doesn't stop in the rest of Ireland. It appears about 160 deaths occur between this stage and the truce. So there's violence going on. And, of course, a couple of days later, the King's troops in a train going back to Dublin is derailed, and police army members are killed and lots of horses are killed. So the violence doesn't stop. We shouldn't think that the next day everyone felt, well, let's have peace. It takes some time and a lot of deaths still to come.
Now we're coming up to the end of our radio segment, and I just want to call in our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, just to sort of talk about the way the commemorations have been handled, and how the job of knitting it into the current situation has been handled. Vincent, there was concern in 2020 that the centenary commemorations would pose a serious challenge to the DUP Sinn Féin relationship. Is it fair to say that events just simply overtook these concerns?
They have indeed, on a number of fronts. I mean, COVID actually has helped in that sense, in that there may have been large-scale parades and celebrations. And, of course, because of the sensitivities around here, you know, Unionists wanted to celebrate. They see this as something to celebrate. Nationalists have made it clear throughout, from Sinn Féin and the SDLP, they didn't view this as something to celebrate. They wanted to mark it in some way. So huge sensitivities around it. Boris Johnson himself said it had to be handled in a very sensitive fashion. So I think in that sense, COVID helped, because it removed the possibility of large-scale parades and probably dialed down the rhetoric a little bit. But in terms of what's happened today, we have Geoffrey Donaldson, who's applying to be DUP leader today, talking about needing to secure the union. We've had unionist politicians in the last few weeks referring to the Northern Ireland Protocol, the sea border, as partitioning the United Kingdom. So they say history is a way of going around the circles and coming back. And in many ways, unionists today see themselves as, again, trying to fight to retain that link with Britain. So it's a mirror image. The sea border has replaced the land border.
Did any consensus emerge between the DUP and Sinn Féin as to how the centenary would be marked? I mean, for example, Arlene Foster said, now it was 2 years ago, that it would be a celebration. She pulled back from that. Michelle O'Neill told the Queen she wanted the Sinn Féin approach to be reconciliation, but also said partition, fail, fail, fail on every count.
The only consensus has been very low key. A list of events agreed by the Northern Ireland Assembly, and the list of events agreed, lectures written competition, open days, exhibitions, another exhibition, a number of speakers events, nothing large scale. It's all small scale. And there was a proposal to have a centenary stone installed at Stormont, Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin opposed that. They were criticised by unionist parties. Even the SDLP had signed up to that as well. So in terms of consensus, no, Sinn Féin wanted this very low-key. They didn't want any kind of large-scale celebration, and that's what's happened. Even here tonight, the City Hall was lit up at 10:30 tonight with animations of the King's visit. Parliament buildings will be lit up this afternoon at 3 o'clock, but again, no large-scale events, and Sinn Féin not involved in any kind of, if you like, reconciliation and holding out the hand for any kind of large-scale event, and Union has been very critical of that.
And will there be any attempt to retrieve the situation, like when COVID has been lifted, that they might actually carry hold some events, or is that it? They'll just move on.
No, I think so. There are events planned throughout the year. The Orange Order has put up Happy Birthday Northern Ireland banners. There are centenary flags and lampposts throughout some lawless areas. So I think certainly the Orange Order would like to hold some kind of events and turn some of their parades into celebrations of Northern Ireland. In terms of Sinn Féin coming forward and any kind of large scale event, no, nothing like that. But certainly unionism will want to celebrate it in some way. Just how, we're not quite sure yet.
Okay, well, we're going to continue on talking about this because we've a lot of issues we haven't had a chance to raise it in the radio segment. So if people want to stay with us on the news channel, we're going to be handing back to Dublin now. We will be continuing the discussion. And as I said, we have a reenactment of the King's speech. We'll be parsing that. My guests are staying with me, Dr. Marie Coleman, Professor Brian Walker, Dr. Eamon Phoenix. But for now, it's back to you in Dublin, Audrey.